From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He's neurotic, self-centered, and devious. No job, no girlfriend. He's also one of the funniest characters on TV. On today's Fresh Air, we meet actor Jason Alexander. He plays George Costanza on the series Seinfeld. Alexander says George is someone he could have been. Also, the frustrations of a doctor in a refugee camp. David Hayden's new book is a journal of his time working with Ethiopian refugees during the famine. He says the doctors became part of the disaster they were sent to contain. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new reissues by violinist Joseph Sigeti. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Israel, television projections are forecasting a victory by the opposition Labor Party over the ruling Likud Party. This would represent Labor's first victory in 15 years. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Tel Aviv.
In past elections, the television projections have been very accurate. And as they were announced this evening, Labor Party headquarters erupted with cheering, singing, and even some crying. According to the projections, the opposition Labor Party has won 47 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. The left-wing Meretz bloc won 13 seats. That means that Labor and Meretz have what is called a blocking majority, which means no government can be formed without them. If the results are correct, it means that opposition Labor leader Yitzhak Rabin will be the next Prime Minister of Israel. It also means a defeat for Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Shamir has so far refused to comment, saying he will wait for final results. I'm Linda Gradstein in Tel Aviv.
The besieged people of Sarajevo came under a renewed artillery attack today as Serbian gunners fired into the center of the Bosnian capital. There was also fighting reported around the Sarajevo airport, where UN peacekeepers installed new radio equipment in the event the airport can be reopened for humanitarian flights. Secretary of State Baker has recommended additional sanctions against Serbia to protest what he called the continuing humanitarian nightmare. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Baker told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee he is recommending what amounts to a break in diplomatic relations. The United States will also push for the suspension of Serbia from international organizations and institutions. Asked about possible U.S. military intervention, Baker said the administration has not ruled out nor ruled in participation in some multilateral action. Baker quickly added discussion of military action is so far only related to the delivery of humanitarian assistance. Baker suggested there is growing frustration within the international community and that further steps may well be taken. He said the administration will consult on these additional steps to ensure the relief operation to Sarajevo is no longer blocked. When one senator noted the ability to provide humanitarian assistance depends on an adequate military force, Baker agreed. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Afghanistan's interim president said today that he'll transfer power this week to a broadly representative government council. At the end of this week, President Sibghatullah Mojaddidi's two-month term was to have ended, and he was supposed to have handed power to the leader of a fundamentalist Islamic faction. Instead, Mojaddidi said the fundamentalists are too radical, and he believes the country would be safer in the hands of a 64-member council, which he heads. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at 3,285.6. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. Russia and Ukraine signed a friendship treaty today that appeared to put some of the two nations' disputes on the back burner. Russian President Boris Yeltsin and Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk concluded a summit at a Russian Black Sea resort by strolling arm in arm as they spoke to reporters. The new agreement would keep the 300-ship Black Sea fleet under joint control, with negotiations on separate navies to come later. The treaty made no mention of a territorial dispute over the Crimean Peninsula, once held by Russia but now controlled by Ukraine. The space shuttle Columbia is experiencing some minor problems today as work continues toward a Thursday afternoon liftoff. The shuttle is scheduled to make history during its 13-day mission. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Technicians are currently troubleshooting a glitch in one of the shuttle's main engine compartments. A fuel sensor has been giving officials faulty readings from main engine number 2. If the sensor needs to be replaced, managers say it will not cause a delay in the countdown. Engineers will also replace 2 of the shuttle's 3 navigational computers used for landing, which had not been acting properly as well. That will be done later this evening after Columbia's onboard cryogenic fuel is loaded. The fuel is used to generate electricity while in orbit. That amount of fuel that Columbia can now carry was expanded during its recent overhaul in California. Those modifications will now allow Columbia to remain in orbit for as many as 16 days. This 13-day mission will be the longest time ever spent in orbit by a space shuttle crew. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Germany's BMW company announced plans today to build a new auto plant in South Carolina. The plant near Greenville is expected to cost between $250 and $300 million. Employment would gradually build up to about 2,000, building 300 cars a day. BMW said the plant will produce a new luxury car. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The sitcom Seinfeld has made Jerry Seinfeld a star, and we're hoping it will do the same for my guest Jason Alexander, who plays Seinfeld's best friend, George. Jerry Seinfeld plays a less successful version of himself, a stand-up comic slowly on the rise. Whereas the character Jerry is reasonably self-confident, nice apartment, good income, George is both self-centered and insecure, devious, resentful, and usually broke. Jerry is trim, thick head of hair. George is stocky and balding. Here's a scene that shows how George can turn even victory into defeat. Jerry and George are talking about the party they went to the night before. George left the party with a woman from work.
What a mistake that party was. I never should have gone.
Yeah, me either.
Oh, come on.
What come on? Have you ever dated a woman that worked in your office?
I never had a job.
You know that anxiety you feel on a date? That's what I have every day now. My worst nightmares come true. Every day is a date.
That's one of Dante's 9 stages of hell, isn't it?
Ava was one of the reasons I used to like going to work. She was a friend. Now we sleep together, and suddenly, I don't know how to talk to her. Every time I go to the bathroom, I pass her desk. I have to plan little patter. I spend half my day writing. Then afterwards, I sit in my office and analyze how it went. If it was a good conversation, I don't go to the bathroom for the rest of the day. I see her laughing and talking with other people. They're all so loose and relaxed. I think, that used to be me. I want to go back there again.
What are you going to do?
I have no choice. I'm quitting.
Of course, that scene was before the episode in which George tried to poison his boss and lost his job. Before co-starring on Seinfeld, Jason Alexander won a Tony Award as the narrator on Jerome Robbins' Broadway. In the film Pretty Woman, Alexander played the smarmy lawyer who propositioned Julia Roberts. I asked Jason Alexander to describe the character he plays on Seinfeld.
Oh, gosh. Better men than I have attempted that. George seems to be the universal less than everyman. He is neurotic. He is, I guess, described as a classical loser. He tries very hard, perhaps too much. He's very nervous about life and about the city he lives in and the way he's going to be treated. He has, at varying times, an overinflated and an underinflated ego. But through it all, he seems to be able to maintain a pretty steady sense of humor about not only the things around him and the people around him, but about himself. And I guess that's his saving grace.
Now, the character of George seems to be the character that's based on the show's co-creator and head writer, Larry David. In fact, Larry David kind of told us that on the show. Uh-huh. So do you feel like you get any tips from, do you get any insights into George by watching the show's co-creator?
Well, you know, on Larry's behalf, George, I hope, is not quite as neurotic, or rather, Larry's not quite as neurotic as George. Actually, the George character did not start out, at least as far as I know, to be Larry David. When I was first shown the role, when you do a pilot for a series, everything happens very quickly and you make quick decisions. And the first thing that came into my head was, this guy's like Woody Allen. And I did a rather shameless Woody Allen impression for the first couple of episodes. And slowly, as the writers got to know us and we got to know them and the show took shape, I started to see that Larry was throwing in a lot of incidents that happened to him, and the character was beginning to have a syntax, very much the way Larry talked. And I went, oh, my God, I think the way to do this is to do Larry. And then I started studying Larry's physical tics and his rhythms and his humors. And it very gradually, and I don't know if it was a conscious effort on either one of us, but the character grew into being sort of an alter ego for Larry. So now, yeah, whenever I'm really stuck on how to do something, I either ask him, you know, Larry, how would you do this? Or I just try and imagine Larry in the situation, and it seems to work.
What's one of the things that you went to him for and said, Larry, how would you do this?
There are, well, there are line readings sometimes. You know, not all the Seinfeld lines make sense to me right off the bat. You know, a lot of line readings. But line readings are a big thing on our show because, you know, we are populated by stand-up comics. Jerry, of course. Michael Richards was a stand-up. Larry David was a stand-up. Several of our writers were stand-ups. So they write very rhythmy things. And, you know, I used to do a bit about how Jerry Seinfeld is the only guy in the world who will say the line, are you going to do it? In the following way. Most people would say, are you going to do it? Or are you going to do it? And Jerry would go, are you going to do it? Is it going to happen? And when I get stuck with some of the line readings, it's because I'm not falling into the Larry David, Jerry Seinfeld reading. So when I get to a line, are you going to do it? And it's not funny. And all of a sudden he says, well, you want to go, are you going to do it? And then all of a sudden somehow it becomes funny.
That's interesting. Yeah, that is how Seinfeld would say it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm noticing, listening to you, that your voice isn't at all like George's voice.
No, not at all.
You have you have a much kind of lighter, quieter, more relaxed voice than he does.
Yeah, and hopefully devoid, for the most part, of the New York accent. Like I said, that all sort of developed from the, you know, I used to, when I really started, I was doing Woody Allen, shamelessly, as I say, and, you know, George sort of became a watered-down version of that.
Well, yeah, George has a little whine in his voice, and his voice sometimes kind of cracks with nervousness, I think.
What do you mean, Terry?
Exactly.
Yeah, he. Well, you know, George takes everything to heart, I'm afraid, and is affected very deeply. He's a very emotional fellow.
Now, how much of George's style of neurosis and anxiety do you understand or do you share?
I understand almost all of it. I hope I don't share too much of it. I have been in therapy for a while, and if I shared too much of it, I would have to ask my money back. I've said before that I think George is possibly what I might have become had my life not gone so well. You know, had people not given me jobs and said, hey, nice job. If I hadn't met, you know, a wonderful woman that decided to marry me and who loves me and takes care of me. And if my mother wasn't such a wonderful lady, and, you know, if I had more friends like Jerry and Elaine that are constantly sort of dishing me, I might have been much more George-like. Fortunately, my life went a little better than that. George is unemployed. George can't get a date. You know, George doesn't think much of himself, and he is surrounded by friends that keep going, well, you know, he's George. That makes for a slightly more insecure person than myself.
Now, Jerry Seinfeld is not an actor. He's a stand-up comic. And according to Larry David, when a situation is written for Jerry that, you know, that he feels is out of character for himself as a person, he doesn't feel comfortable acting something out if he wouldn't do it as a person himself. So mm-hmm. Your character ends up with that, with that situation.
Yeah, usually it gets thrown to either Julia or myself. Jerry, you know, to his credit, Jerry realized his limitations as an actor going into the show. And I think what has made him so appealing is that he doesn't do things he can't do. In fact, if you watch the show, you'll see that Jerry half the time is about to crack up at what's going on around him. And, you know, when I first started watching, I went, Jerry, you got to stop doing that. You're blowing it. But it actually has become part of the charm of the show and of his character. And Jerry in life, in public life, is not comfortable, you know, with great shows of affection or sexuality. He very rarely gets hot under the collar or angry, or at least not to the point where it's expressed. So for him to do those things on camera would make him extremely uncomfortable. And subsequently, he doesn't do it very much. And if a scene calls for any kind of sexuality, they'll usually throw it to Julia. And if it calls for extreme emotionality, they'll usually throw it to me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Alexander, and he plays George Costanza in the sitcom Seinfeld. Was this your first TV experience?
Oh, gosh, no. I had done two other series before Seinfeld. One was a series that has an incredible longevity on the Lifetime cable network. Considering we only did one season, it was a show called ER, starring Elliot Gould and Mary McDonald, about an emergency room in Chicago, which was an old Norman Lear series that had no ratings when it was on the air. I mean, it was like number 72 out of 72, but they have been repeating the 22 episodes that were done over and over and over on Lifetime, and people have been really responding to it.
Huh.
And then in 88, I had a series of my own out of New York called Everything's Relative, which I'm sure you remember. It was just a ratings hit. We shot 10 episodes, and they aired 6, and then we went to lunch one day, and we came back, and everyone was gone, and they said, well, that's it. So, no, it was not my first experience, but it was certainly my most successful one.
Well, were you bracing yourself for another big failure when you started?
Well, you know, honestly, I don't think any of us thought that the show would be a tremendous success. Excuse me. We all loved the script, and I thought it was one of the best things I had ever read. But I really went into it thinking the audience for this show is me. And I don't really watch television. So if we're depending on people like me to support us, it's just not going to be there. I knew, or I felt, that the show would not reach a mainstream audience. And so I thought, you know, we're going to be in and out. And in fact, when the pilot was done and it was audience tested, it tested horribly. And nobody wanted to put the show on the air. And I think NBC threw it on just to fill a half-hour slot. And it had an enormous critical response, and then all of a sudden people started to rethink. But the fact that we seem to be rising in the ratings so steadily, and that much older people, you know, my mother's generation seems to be taking to it, some teenagers are taking to it, college kids are taking to it. No one is more surprised about that than all of us.
Hmm. My guest is Jason Alexander, who plays George Costanza in the sitcom Seinfeld. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Jason Alexander. Now, you got a Tony Award for Best Actor in the Broadway musical Jerome Robbins, Broadway. You were mm-hmm. the narrator, and I believe you also wrote the script for it that you had to read, the part you had to read?
Yeah. It's very easy to win awards when you write your own part. The Robbins show, just the quick background on that was that Jerry knew he wanted to do all these numbers. He just didn't know how to make an evening of it. And the idea was that he was going to have someone sort of host or narrate the evening, which sounded very unexciting to me. And the idea became, well, why don't you create the way to do that? And what I did essentially is I became a character from every show represented. Sometimes to great use and sometimes just for 20 seconds so that it could get into a dance number. And the result was that I was playing about 14 different characters in the course of the night. And in that particular season, it was a very flashy role. It was not a very substantial role, but it was pretty flashy. And so they threw an award at me.
How did you learn to sing and dance? And I should say, you know, that just seeing you as George on Seinfeld, I wouldn't see you and say, well, there's a music comedy star. Do you know what I mean? I just hadn't thought of you as singing.
Yeah. I don't know. I was always, I think I probably went into acting because of of musicals. When I was a kid, I was just drawn to show music. My mother says that we used to take long family vacations, and I would sing the complete scores of show albums in the car. My sister had a big collection of them, and it was just the music that I found the most interesting. And so when I was old enough to start going to the theater, my folks naturally took me to musicals, and it was all I wanted to do. So I was constantly singing. And I got serious about it, I guess, as a young teenager, and I started taking lessons and
singing lessons.
The dancing thing was just a natural offshoot. I was serious about being an actor when I was 13 and 14, and I said, well, I guess I can sing well enough now, but I've noticed that in these musicals, the singers often have to move, so maybe I should learn how to do that. And I went out to, you know, like a local dance school and started taking tap. And when I went to college as an acting major, you have to study ballet and jazz. And so it was just a natural offshoot. But one thing that the Robin Show taught me, since I was working with 70 of the best dancers I've ever seen in my life, was that I'm not a dancer. I'm sort of fearless about moving. If they say you're going to do this, I go, okay. And I try and do it with enough pizzazz that nobody looks at my feet.
Did your friends rib you when you were young and taking tap dance lessons?
They never knew. I went four towns away. And I never talked about it, and I never displayed it, because I basically thought I'd be shot through the head by any one of them if they knew.
How did it feel to you to really love doing something that you felt you should be very embarrassed about?
Well, you know, that's sort of the way my whole childhood went. I always loved performing, and I did it as much as I could, but I was always scared to death to be on stage. Performing was an offshoot for me from the fact that when I was a very small child, I was really very, very fat. And to prevent other kids from being mean to me, I would just entertain. Usually what I did is I memorized comedy albums. When I was a kid, there was lots of comic. Every comic did an album. And I would just memorize their material and start doing it. And, and the kids thought I was making it up. I was telling Bill Cosby stories about growing up black in Philadelphia, and they all went, hey, did that really happen to you? And, yeah, right. it wasn't that I hid my performance things. I hid anything that would label me, you know, the big term in school, and you run and cry if anyone called you a fag. So I tried to hide the faggier things about what I was doing. I wouldn't sing around the halls of the school. I would only sing when I had to, and I never danced in school. I waited until I got out, and unfortunately, I think a lot of young people do that. You hide a lot of who you are and what you are because you're afraid to not fit in, and I went that route until many, many years later.
Although you felt you shouldn't let your friends know about these interests of yours, were you confident that they were really legitimate interests yourself?
On my part, yeah. I knew that I was very serious about this. The first time I really set foot on a stage, it sounds silly, but it was my bar mitzvah. And I was 13 years old, and I got up, and I had all these lines and all these songs and a packed house, and my name was on the marquee outside.
And on the matchbooks,
I'm
sure.
And I made a ton of money. And I said, this is not a bad thing. I could really enjoy this. And I got very serious about it. And I always knew that this was what I was going to do. And thankfully, I had a family that was supportive of it. But it was just a matter of not... While as a teenager, not letting other people really get too in on it, because they could have been cruel enough and I was weak enough that they could have destroyed it for me. So it was just self-preservation.
How self-conscious were you about your weight when you were young?
Oh, Terry, I never had a good-looking year as a teenager. You know what I'm saying? I was fat until I was 17. I had braces for 9 years, and when I was 18, I started losing my hair. I could not get a break, Terry. I was as self-conscious as not. Actually, I was less self-conscious about the weight than anything else because I never looked as heavy as I was, and I avoided mirrors. So I didn't, I didn't look too hard. The braces I knew were there because they were cutting my lips from the inside. And the hair I knew was going because I would get sunburnt on the top of my head. But you know, it wasn't until I actually got sick as a teenager. I became asthmatic, and I couldn't catch my breath to eat, so I started losing weight, and they said, that's a good idea for you to keep doing that. And I've been fighting that battle ever since.
So what was your early stabs? What were your early stabs at show business?
Actually, my whole career was so incredibly lucky. I was fooling around and doing all kinds of community theater and children's theater in New Jersey where I was growing up. And I got involved with this children's theater group that was asked to videotape two of their shows for local television in New York. And we did that, and we all had to join AFTRA in order to be in it. So at age 17, I was in the union. And an agent in New York saw the shows and asked me to join the company. So I had an agent at age 17 while I was still in high school, and I skipped that whole phase that most actors go through where they pound the streets going, help me, somebody help me. And I went to college with all this in hand, and I started doing commercials then. And
what kind of commercials?
Oh, man, I did commercials, one of which is still running. My most famous one was for Western Union, where there's a kid at a police station, and the cop is standing there with reflector glasses, and he's calling his father, and he says, Dad, is there any way you could send them the cash today? And I get the cash, and I go back to the cop and say, keep in touch. That's still running.
I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, that was a biggie. I did commercials for, I was the original McDLT man when the McDonald's created that product. I did Canada Dry. I did Bic Razors with John McEnroe. I think I did almost 100 commercials when I was doing commercials regularly.
Now, your birth name was Greenspan, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, when did you change it to Alexander?
The minute I could. I changed it when I went to AFTRA to get that union card. My name is J. Scott Greenspan, and I always grew up sort of hating the name because Greenspan was one of those names that was just so easy on the playground to make fun of. It was green, fill in the blank, or whatever. And I said, I got to get rid of this thing as soon as I can. So I was going to use Jason because I always thought Jason was stronger than Jay, and it, you know, had this sort of Herculean image of myself. And I was going to use Jason Scott, and I went into AFTRA and they said, what is your name going to be? And I said, Jason Scott. And they said, we have 19 of them. Pick something else. And I had never thought about anything else. So I felt bad about dropping my family name. So I took my father's first name, which was Alexander, and they said, okay, fine. And boom, it was done.
Very ethnically neutral name.
Isn't it, though? And I'll tell you the other advantage it has. When you're in the cast list and it's alphabetical, boy, that works out very well.
Oh, that's in fact, true.
I was thinking of changing my name to Jason A. Alexander, just to ensure that I would always be at the top.
Did that enter into your choosing it?
Not at all. No, uh-huh. I was too naive at that point to think that I would ever be anything other than, you know, star billing above the title.
One last thing, you know, one of the musicals I really wish I'd seen, but it was only open for 2 weeks, was Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along, in which
yes,
you had
ma'am.
A part. Was that a great disappointment for you when it closed so quickly?
Yes and no. It hurt in that it was the first, you know, I always thought anything I touched would turn to gold because, you know, in high school I was the big star, in college I was the big star, and things were always great. And here you are, here was my first entree into the professional world, and I worked as hard as I could, and it was with, you know, the legends of the business, and it didn't go. And that was a real education and a disappointment.
One last question. You used to do impressions as a kid. Do you still do impressions of people?
Very few. I live my life as a walking impression of William Shatner. I do Woody Allen from time to time. And I've been known to throw a Don Adams in here and there. And I do a lot of obscure cartoon characters that nobody remembers anymore.
Oh.
But if they turned to me and said, okay, you're an impressionist, go make a living, I would be quickly on welfare.
I don't think I could let you leave without at least a sentence worth of William Shatner.
Oh, William Shatner?
Uh-huh.
Terry, I want to say that I have enjoyed this interview immensely. And I hope that we can continue it some other time.
Great. Oh, Jason Alexander, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Wish you the best.
Thanks.
Jason Alexander co-stars in the NBC sitcom Seinfeld. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, an account of treating the sick during the Ethiopian famine. It's the subject of David Hyden's new book, Dust to Dust. He was a doctor at a refugee camp in eastern Sudan, a camp Hyden said had the sickest population, the worst political problems, and the least organized staff. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new reissues featuring violinist Joseph Sigeti performing music by Bach. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. If election projections are correct, it appears the Labor Party in Israel will return to power for the first time in 15 years. Exit polls commissioned by state-owned Israeli television predict Labor and left-wing parties will win 64 seats in the 120-member Israeli parliament. If this agrees with final election results, then Yitzhak Rabin will be his nation's new prime minister. He told supporters tonight he wants to include all the positive forces of the people and further peacemaking while ensuring security. Nelson Mandela's African National Congress has pulled out of talks with the South African government. At a news conference, Mandela charged that the government has waged a terrorist campaign against blacks. Tom Carver reports from Johannesburg.
2.5 years after the ANC's unbanning, they have negotiated with the government and come out the other side without any major political changes. In that time, their grassroots supporters have become increasingly restless. The Boipatong massacre was the final straw. The government of President de Klerk, Cyril Ramaphosa, the ANC's Secretary General, said, had brought the country to the brink of disaster. Once the demands of the ANC have been met, Nelson Mandela said they would consider returning to the negotiating table. The ANC hope that this will force the pace of political change. The danger is that they will unleash a mass action which they cannot control. For his part, President de Klerk said it was like lighting a match next to a gasoline tank. There was no alternative, he added, to constructive negotiations. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Carver in Johannesburg.
Campaign reports released today by the Clinton campaign reveal that the Democratic contender is facing growing debt. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Bill Clinton's campaign is almost $4 million in debt, according to Federal Election Commission reports. Clinton has raised more than $14 million, but the intensity of the primary campaign made it more expensive than expected. Clinton and the Democratic Party have also had difficulty raising money this year because of the recession and the uncertainty caused by a three-way race for president. Clinton has had to borrow about $400,000 from the Democratic Party for a nationally televised campaign appearance, and he's had trouble paying his staff on time. As usual, the Democrats continue to trail the Republicans in fundraising. By the end of May, President Bush had outraised Clinton by almost 2-1. His FEC report shows that the Republicans have raised more than $24 million for his reelection effort. Ross Perot's FEC report for May was not available, although he is expected to outspend both Bush and Clinton. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 5 points to close at 3,285.62 in fairly active trading. This is NPR News. According to a spokesman for the Association of American Railroads, contracts have been reached with two rail unions. However, he also says that talks continue with four other larger rail unions and major freight lines and their unions in advance of a midnight strike deadline. If there is a strike, commuters in the East Coast could face major transportation problems. Amtrak has said that it will close commuter operations at New York's Penn Station, and many long-distance trips have already been curtailed. The UN cultural body, UNESCO, which in the past has been considered by some to be a center of pro-Arab sentiment, has opened a conference aimed at fighting anti-Semitism. This Congress comes at the same time that UNESCO officials are trying to get the U.S. to rejoin the organization. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The conference began with a tape message from President Bush, who thanked UNESCO for holding the meeting together with the anti-Nazi group, the Simon Wiesenthal Center. UNESCO Director General Federico Mayor denied that the conference was meant to woo the U.S. back into the fold. Washington used to contribute a quarter of UNESCO's budget, but in 1984 it withdrew, complaining that the organization was politically biased and poorly managed. Mayor said he'd like UNESCO to be truly international, but he maintained that he would never campaign the U.S. directly. However, UNESCO officials said the organization's deputy director general is now in Washington trying to do just that. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
In the former Soviet Union, Russia and Ukraine have agreed to share control of the Black Sea Fleet. Under a new friendship treaty, Ukraine will be allowed to have its own currency, and borders of the two states will be open to travel. At the treaty signing ceremony today, Russian leader Boris Yeltsin said that each nation has the right to build its own armed force. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Idealism helped lead Dr. David Hyden to Africa during the Ethiopian famine in 1985. But when he got there, he faced circumstances beyond his comprehension or control, and he felt he had become part of the disaster he was sent to contain. His 3 months in two refugee camps in eastern Sudan are described in his new book, Dust to Dust, A Doctor's View of Famine in Africa. The book also includes some of the photographs he took. The first refugee camp he worked at in Sudan was known as FAO 3. He describes it as having the sickest population, the worst political problems, and the least organized expatriate staff. There were 3 doctors for 13,000 people. The drive to FAO 3 from the airport took several days. The closer Dr. Hyden got, the more desolate the land became.
I felt like we had really left Africa and were driving on the moon. On one side of the car, there was just baked, black, cracked, flat dirt sort of stretching to the horizon. And on the other side was a raised mound of dirt that was from digging a canal, which was the water source for the camp. It was an irrigation canal, but it was the reason the camp was placed there. There were no trees. When we drove up to FAO 3, there were just rows of brown, dusty tents. And then we pulled into a compound where the expatriate health workers were living. So it was really an empty, frightening sort of... When I got there, I sort of emotionally felt if there was that it was like, this is a mistake. If there was some way to get back in the car and drive away, I mean, I would have been tempted to do it.
You expected some kind of welcome when you got there, but you didn't get any. And you said that the medical workers there weren't letting in newcomers outside their circle of pain. What was their emotional and physical states when you arrived?
I think that they had been exposed to something that people have no capacity really to be exposed to. I mean, they had been working nonstop in this really terrible place where half the children were malnourished and they were watching children die every day. And what they could do was severely limited by a whole host of problems. And they were just really drained. At the time, I resented it, and I had something in the book about that, but in retrospect, I totally understand it.
What were the most common medical problems that you found at the refugee camp? Besides starvation, which was probably the predominant problem.
Most of the medical problems were starvation plus. malnutrition plus something else. And in the people with malnutrition, there were all these things that you heard about prisoners of war getting in the Second World War, like beriberi and pellagra and scurvy and really terrible things that there's just no excuse for people to suffer in this world. But on top of that, there was an awful lot of dysentery because the water was polluted. And initially, we didn't have the right things to put in it, chlorine. And initially, the tank that was set up to put the water in was just the wrong type, and it made the pollution settle, and then it drew the water from the polluted sludge, sort of. The other problems were respiratory illnesses, different types of pneumonia, and particularly TB.
Now, I want to get back to, you know, the diarrhea and dysentery that was so common at the camp because the water was polluted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you treat that when you're a doctor? Sure, you could give them antibiotics, but if the water's still going to be polluted, they're going to get the problem again.
Yeah, that's a great question. That gets back to sort of a fundamental issue in these types of situations, and that's priorities. What's most important? And doctors are really, doctors and hospitals, they're potent symbols of helping. But what's much more important is just providing people with clean water and decent food and shelter. And you can't, like your question, you know, sort of suggests, you can't treat people for dysentery if you're going to send them back out to drink the same polluted water. I mean, chlorinating the water would have properly and purifying it decently, filtering it, would have been more important than anything else we did.
Now, how come there wasn't chlorine?
Good question. How come there wasn't chlorine? How come the children weren't immunized? How come there wasn't enough food? These are all things that the world has in abundance, and that's really what I hope the book brings people to get a sense of. How can we let these horrors happen when for pennies we can prevent them? How can we let children die because of a couple pennies of chlorine? I mean, there just wasn't enough support. There wasn't enough organization.
Well, you left with the flu. You had bronchitis by the time you arrived in Sudan, and then within a week, I think, you got dysentery.
It was a week and a half.
Excuse me. So how sick could you be and still work?
I was actually pretty healthy the whole time, and the level of illness, I mean, most people got trivial things. I mean, everybody got trivial things like sort of minor diarrheas, things like that. But there was a level of serious illnesses that made people incapable of being able to work. For instance, when one of my colleagues got bitten by a viper, she was out for 3 weeks. When another one of my colleagues got hepatitis, she was sent home. And there were three or four people, not from my specific camp, but from the different camps, that were evacuated to Switzerland with typhoid fever. Thankfully, nobody died. On the Thai-Cambodian border, actually, in 1980, someone died.
While you were at one of the camps in Sudan, there was a meningitis epidemic. And meningitis apparently can kill a healthy adult in a matter of hours.
Yeah.
How contagious is it?
It's highly contagious, and the frightening thing about it is that during an epidemic, a large number of people will carry the bacteria in their throat but not be sick, but they're able to spread it. So when you start seeing people get sick with meningitis, you know that even if you're very careful around them, that there are many other people that are carrying the bacteria that, you know, can spread it.
So what could you do to prevent the spread of meningitis in the refugee camp where the basic supply you had was antibiotics?
Well, we thought hard about it, and what we did, in fact, which worked, it was one of the things that was nice. We immediately tried to get a hold of vaccine. There is an excellent vaccine. And that was one of the frustrating episodes in the book. But finally, we did get vaccine. And in a period of 3 days, we immunized the entire camp, 13,000 people, and the epidemic ended. That was nice.
What'd you do for yourself?
Same thing as the context. We took preventive antibiotic, and when the vaccine came, like the rest of the refugees, we got vaccinated. There was only one of us that had been vaccinated in advance, which was just poor planning. We all should have known better, and we should have been immunized before we went, because this region in Africa is known as the meningitis belt of Africa.
Hmm. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Hayden, and he's a doctor based in San Francisco. He's worked in several refugee camps. In 1985, he spent 3 months in refugee camps in Sudan for people starving. This is during the Ethiopian famine. And his new journal of that period is called Dust to Dust, and it includes the photographs that he took in the camps. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. David Hayden, author of the new book Dust to Dust, about his work as a doctor in Ethiopian refugee camps during the famine of 1985. You took a vacation from the camp for a week, and you decided not to go back. Why couldn't you go back?
I don't know. I felt like I couldn't face it again. I wanted to keep working, but I just felt like I couldn't spend another day in FAO 3. It was really painful. I felt like I'd failed, but I ended up going to another camp and continuing my tour of duty.
After your vacation, you went to a different refugee camp in the Sudan. You went to a camp called Wad Khali. Am I pronouncing
mm-hmm.
that right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was right across the border from Ethiopia. Was that a better place for you to work?
By all means. It was a very much more humane environment. The living situation for the expatriates had been organized much better. I mean, we had regular meals. Everybody had their own little thatch hut. It was along the riverbed of the Atbara River. It's the last tributary of the Nile. And there were just the scenic components of Africa. I felt like I was no longer on the backside of the moon, sort of buried somewhere. I felt like I had returned to Africa.
Mm-hmm. What's it like kind of psychologically to have, you know, your own hut and to have decent meals every day when a lot of people around you who you're there to serve don't have it? Is there a feeling of kind of guilt that comes along with that, or were you reconciled about that?
That's a good... There are conflicts, and they sometimes you don't see them, and then they pop out at all times. Like the first night there was a tropical rain. We didn't know whether the rains were going to come. They'd failed several years, and then it rained, and I was lying in my hut, and there's this joy of seeing it just pour, and then it got a little cold, and I got another sweater to wear, and then all of a sudden I started thinking that right down the way there were 40,000 refugees, and they were living in these little thatch huts that were built to keep out the sun and wouldn't keep out rain at all. And they were lying on the ground, and the ground was this type of clay that turns into mud. And I just sort of lay there. I mean, it was... So, you know, you sort of accept what you have, and then periodically you get these rude reminders, and you sort of take pause.
One last question. Do you feel still kind of psychologically affected by the experience? How much is it still with you?
I'm a different person. I'm vulnerable to different things. So yeah, I'm psychologically affected from it. But I think changed, really.
Mm-hmm.
For the better, I would hope.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Hyden's new book, Dust to Dust, A Doctor's View of Famine in Africa, is published by Temple University Press. Dr. Hyden lives in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight, a report from South Africa. The African National Congress is announcing they are pulling out of talks with the government there about a new constitution. Elizabeth Arnold reports on vice presidential choice possibilities for Bill Clinton and Ross Perot. Richard Ben Kramer on his new big book about the 1988 American presidential campaign. A tribute to MFK Fisher, the venerated food writer who died yesterday in California. And we'll talk with Denise Giardina, author of a book called The Unquiet Earth, a novel about the coal fields of West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky. The book covers the 1930s through the 1980s.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The current trend in Baroque music is to play it only on so-called early instruments. But classical music critic Lord Schwartz says we might overlook some great performances if we limit ourselves to original instruments. One of the 20th century Bach pioneers was the Hungarian Jewish violinist Joseph Szigeti, who recorded Bach long before the original instrument movement took hold. Lord has a review of two recent reissues that feature Szigeti playing Bach.
Earlier in the century, one of Bach's best-loved pieces was his Concerto for Two Violins, also known as the Double Concerto. In 1940, George Balanchine used it for one of his best-loved ballets, Concerto Barocco. But it doesn't seem to be performed much anymore. Maybe it's too expensive for orchestras to hire two soloists. But the Double Concerto is a marvelous piece. Its two lively, rhythmically tricky outer movements surround a slow movement of the most urgent lyricism. Joseph Szigeti's 1937 recording, which has just been reissued on a Pearl compact disc, was made at the height of his technical powers. He plays second violin, the part probably played by Bach himself. His partner is Carl Flesch, one of the great performers and pedagogues of the generation preceding Szigeti's. Bach's sonatas and partitas for solo violin are even more difficult works, certainly more searching and complex than Bach's six suites for solo cello. The 16-minute Chaconne from the second partita is one of the world's masterworks for a solo instrument. No other performance I've heard matches the heroic drama and subtlety of Szigeti's playing here. These landmark recordings were originally made in the mid-1950s and have just been reissued on a Vanguard two-disc set. ¶¶ Many early instrument performances tend to rob Bach of his daring sense of exploration. Earlier violinists this century turned difficult Bach into an excuse for virtuoso display. The purity of Sighetti's style makes all of his Bach performances sound timeless, while his uncanny phrasing keeps them continually fresh and revealing. Sighetti's Bach speaks, and it speaks to us. Along with the Bach Double Concerto on the Pearl CD are two powerful examples of Sighetti in a far more romantic style. Sighetti was also a champion of contemporary music. He was a good friend of the Swiss-born Jewish composer Ernest Bloch, who settled in this country in 1938. The large-scale violin concerto that Bloch dedicated to Sighetti is remarkable for its use of Native American themes. Sighetti recorded it with Charles Munch and the Paris Conservatory Orchestra in 1939, less than a year after the world premiere in Cleveland. The other piece on this album, Nigun, which means improvisation, is a movement from Bloch's 1923 Baal Shem Suite, Three Pieces from Hasidic Life. This 1928 recording with Sighetti and pianist Karl Ruhrseitz is irresistible in its uninhibited outpouring of Yiddish melancholy.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed two new CDs on the Vanguard and Pearl labels, featuring historic recordings by Joseph Sighetti. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Seuss Bolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, working with some of the most despised people in America, we'll talk with Brian Stevenson, a lawyer who represents death row inmates in Alabama. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.